With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Farmers and water districts seek solutions in and out of court and Flo's fight. Central Valley water districts are working to achieve a more holistic approach for San Joaquin River fisheries through voluntary agreements, while also pursuing court challenges to a state plan on downstream flows for fish. Central to the issue is a plan adopted in 2018 by the California State Water Resources Control Board that requires affected water users to leave unimpaired flows of 30 to 50% in three San Joaquin tributaries, the Stanislaus, Tulum, and Merced Rivers. Water districts and farmers have protested the plan, saying it cuts water supplies while doing little to help fish. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report. And now let's get into today's show headlines, sticking to the topic of water. Water rights legislations. Introduced this year were three bills that essentially challenge the California water rights system: Assembly Bill 460, Assembly Bill 1337, and Senate Bill 389. Andrew Genasi, executive director with Stanislaus County Farm Bureau, said of the three,
SB 389 is the only one still standing. That bill has been significantly changed and amended to the point where most agriculture and water groups that were opposed to it are now neutral. All it says now is that the State Water Board can investigate senior water rights, which is something that it wasn't expressly listed in that the early water legislation, that they have the right to look at the validity of the amount of water you're claiming under your pre-1914 senior water rights. So this would allow the state board to investigate to make sure that, yes, you do have a valid claim, and yes, you're using the correct amount of water. And like I said, these things have been watched over. There's a lot of paperwork. The people who have these senior water rights are very confident that they have, that they're good. So if the State Water Board wants to look at it, fine. Go ahead and look at it.
Stay tuned as we'll hear more from Genasi later in today's show. But for right now, here's AgNet West Brian Derman with more agriculture news.
Mating disruption can be an effective management strategy for vine mealybug. Entomology and pest management advisor with UC Cooperative Extension in Kern County, David Haviland, described some of the best mating disruption approaches for vine mealybug.
So grapes is a slightly different situation. For navel orangeworm, you're dealing with a pest where the males and females both fly. They fly very long distances and, you know, immigrate in and out of a field. Vine mealybug's very different because you have females that don't fly. They only move a few inches or at most a few feet within their entire lifespan. The males are very weak flyers. The males and females tend to be very close with each other to start with, and they tend to be hidden underneath the bark on the grapevine. So because of that, this is a case where the, you know, one per acre aerosol types of products that work very well for navel orangeworm actually don't work very well for vine mealybug. For vine mealybug, you want lots and lots of individual point sources. And so the most effective products tend to be what we call hangers, where you'll put anywhere from maybe 150 to 250 products that you would hang or twist onto the wires within the vineyard. But actually the most effective product in that case is sprayable products that you would apply just like a regular pesticide application every 4 weeks. Those tend to be very effective at shutting down the male's ability to find pheromone traps. And we use that as a measure of their ability to find females. So interesting that, you know, the main disruption products, the types of products that work best for vine mealybug don't work for navel orangeworm. And the products that work best for navel orangeworm don't tend to work very well for vine mealybug. That's where you're trying to match up the right dispensing system with the biology of the pest.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
GMOs? Genetically engineered? Bioengineered? What's what? Well, GMO stands for genetically modified organism. It's the common term many people use for foods created through a process scientists call genetic engineering. and you'll start seeing bioengineered on some food packages to let you know the product or some of its ingredients come from GMOs. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, if it's not broken, don't fix it. That's the resounding message from Michigan Congressman Dan Kildee when it comes to the nation's sugar policy.
Well, I think what we have is a program that works. We have a system right now that ensures that domestically grown sugar is sold into our markets before we allow for competition to come from offshore. This kind of protection allows American sugar growers to not have to face unfair competition from state-subsidized sugar that is grown often using workers in dangerous working conditions. So what we have is a system that has worked quite well, supplies our manufacturers with the sugar they need, the food processors with the sugar they need, at a fair price that doesn't undermine American farmers. And so what we have is a system that works. I just want to keep it in place.
With that in mind, he has a simple request for Congress as they craft the 2023 Farm Bill.
Well, I hope that my colleagues recognize that the program we have that is in place right now is working. I have 2,000 family sugar beet growers, you know, in my district alone that support our local economy. There are lots of other members of Congress who have similar situations. I want them to see that the program has worked. Our growers are able to stay in business. Those family farmers are able to support their families. And we want to keep that in place. So my goal for this farm bill when it comes to sugar policy is to not fix what's not broken. It works. And we ought to keep it in place. And I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that's the case.
There have been previous years, such as 2013, when sugar dumping was a problem for U.S. producers. Kildee explains what sugar dumping is.
Sure. It's a process where offshore growers, growers in other countries, can often produce sugar at well below what domestic producers would have to pay to produce their sugar. And sometimes even below their own production costs, they'll dump sugar into a market with the idea of forcing control of that market to go to them. And then, of course, they have control and they can continue to have access to that market and charge whatever they would like. So it's a way to force our growers out of the market so that they can take market share from us. The really difficult aspect of this is that those countries that are involved in dumping are the very countries that have no environmental standards, that have no labor standards. You know, I visited the Dominican Republic last year, for example, specifically to look at the sugar industry there. And I saw the closest thing to slave labor that I've ever seen. I mean, these are very often in Dominican Republic, Haitian workers with no paperwork and no ability to speak for themselves who are, I think, exploited. And, you know, and to my way of thinking, it's not what the American consumer would want to know that they were supporting if, in fact, we did not have a sugar program that put American growers first.
Kildee reiterates he'd like to see things stay the way they are now.
I'd be thrilled if the language that we've been able to defend, you know, I've been in Congress now 11 years. We've had a couple of attacks against the sugar program. We've been able to succeed in beating those back. If we can keep what we have right now, I'm confident that the growers I represent are going to continue to be able to support their families, and that's why I do this work.
The U.S. Sugar Alliance says U.S. sugar policy is based on the common sense notion that supply and demand should be in balance. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, continued dryness over much of the country is behind the growing very poor to poor pasture and rangeland condition ratings for the nation as a whole. With more on that story, here's Rod Bain.
Another week-over-week decline in total U.S. pasture and rangeland conditions, per the most recent USDA report for the period ending September 10th.
We have seen some late-season heat recently. It's also been relatively dry across large parts of the country, at least up through September 10th.
As a result,
we're seeing just one-third of the nation's rangeland and pasture, 33% rated good to excellent. That is a 3 percentage point decrease from last week. At the same time, 39% very poor to poor. That's a 3-point increase from last week on September 3rd.
Rippey adds that pasture and rangeland very good to excellent condition is slightly better than this time last year.
There are 13 states where pastures are rated at least 60% good to excellent, almost all of them in the eastern United States and the vast majority in the Northeast. But there are 3 states in the West where we have seen a little bit wetter weather this summer.
Those states, Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Rod. And USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey talks more about pasture and rangeland in that very poor to poor condition category by state.
We actually see 14 states at this point where rangeland and pastures are rated at least 40% very poor to poor. They kind of fall into 4 different clusters. We've got one area across the Deep South, another area mainly across the Western Corn Belt, a third area in the Northwest, and then a 4th area kind of in the Mid-Atlantic region. We have seen some rain in the Mid-Atlantic recently, so we might see those pastures start turning back around there. I'm going to focus in on the first 3 areas there. Starting off with the Midwest there, we actually see 5 states where we see at least 40% of the pastures very poor to poor. That list includes Iowa, Kansas, Minnesota, Missouri, and Wisconsin. Top of that list is Minnesota at 64% very poor to poor. We have that other area across the Deep South where it's been a hot, dry summer. Texas coming in number 1 in the nation this week at 72% very poor to poor. And the third area to focus on is the Northwest. Also been a hot, dry summer in parts of the Pacific Northwest. We do see Washington State coming in this week 54% very poor to poor.
Again, that was USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey. And World Dairy Expo is reminding producers that they are going to be hosting a dairy symposium next month featuring the dairy business innovation initiatives from across the country. That event will take place on October 3rd during World Dairy Expo. Registration is underway. The Dairy Symposium will include a presentation by each of the DBI initiatives about their regional efforts. That does include the Pacific Coast Coalition Dairy Business Innovation Initiative out of California. Now, the Dairy Symposium is free to attend with a paid admission to World Dairy Expo. Again, that's coming up October 3rd. To learn more, simply go to worlddairyexpo.com. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
If your soil could talk, what would it say? If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
How good is your diet? Few of us would say it's excellent. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. New data from USDA's Economic Research Service shows Americans don't have high ratings for their diets. In the period covering January of 2017 through March of 2020, just under 3 in 10 adults, or 29%, reported that the healthfulness of their diets was very good or excellent. That is 3.5 percentage points lower than the corresponding share reported in 2005-2006. The data can be found in the latest publicly available wave of the Flexible Consumer Behavior Survey, which collects information on U.S. consumers' knowledge, attitudes, and beliefs about nutrition and food choices. For context, 41% of adults surveyed in the 1989 through 1991 continuing survey of food intakes of individuals rated the healthfulness of their diets as very good or excellent, suggesting a continued downward trend in the health quality individuals ascribe to their diets. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
In today's Modern Ag Report, trees and green spaces have many benefits. More after the break. USDA has recently announced a project to boost access to green spaces and trees. USDA's Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack talks about the benefits of trees and green spaces.
A tree canopy can reduce temperatures by anywhere from 11 to 19 degrees. In doing so, they can also help lower energy costs for consumers. We know that trees soak up CO2 and other pollutants and therefore have a mitigating effect on the impacts and the adverse impacts of the climate crisis. They provide better air quality and so provide healthcare benefits, certainly in terms of people who are suffering from asthma and other lung-related diseases.
To learn more about the funded proposals, you can visit USDA's Urban and Community Forestry Program webpage. And with more on this, here's USDA's Gary Crawford talking about the projects to boost access to green space for millions.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says in talking about efforts to bring high-speed internet to everyone,
no community should be left behind.
But this time he's talking about another effort
to expand investment in urban and community forestry.
Vilsack was in Cedar Rapids, Iowa Thursday to announce a $1 billion investment for 385 projects to plant trees and increase access to green space for millions of Americans who don't have that access. Vilsack told reporters with programs like this,
we believe that we can create more resilient communities in terms of the impacts of climate. We think we can mitigate extreme heat incidences and events in many of the cities where projects and awards will be made.
Vilsack said tree canopies have been shown to reduce average temperatures by up to 19 degrees, saving energy costs for residents. He said most of the projects will be in underserved communities where residents have little or no access to green space. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. During the fracking process of oil and gas production, water is produced. With new technology, the produced water can be treated and then sold back to operators for drilling. But who owns the produced water? Is it the mineral lessee or the holder of the water rights? Who owns the water that is produced from oil and gas operations? A recent Texas court case answered that question. A company used fracking in its oil and gas activity, and over the years, its operations resulted in more than 52 million barrels of produced water. That water can be treated and then sold back to the operators for drilling. The company had surface use and right-of-way agreements with the surface owners to transport product and waste, including produced water, from its wells. The surface owners later transferred all of their water rights to another company, including ownership and the right to sell all water produced from oil and gas wells and the formations on or under the leased land. The legal question was whether the mineral lease conveyed the produced water to the oil and gas operator. The trial court said it did, and the appellate court agreed. Produced water is considered an oil and gas waste rather than water, and there was nothing in the mineral leases indicating the parties intended to modify that common practice. Make sure to address the issue of produced water before you sign an oil and gas lease. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
This case represents the first time that the sanitary, phytosanitary provisions of USMCA have been exercised.
What U.S. Trade Representative's Office Chief Agricultural Negotiator Doug McCaleb is referring to is our nation's recent request for a dispute settlement panel within the framework of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement to settle concerns with Mexican bans of biotech food products, such as genetically modified corn from the U.S.
Unfortunately, they have put in place presidential decrees that have singled out biotechnology and really set up a situation that threatens to disrupt trade between our countries, could potentially harm U.S. farmers, and quite frankly, stifle innovation at a time when we all need to be seeking solutions to climate change and to productivity challenges.
Previous consultations between the two nations over the issue failed to produce a solution, leading to the dispute settlement panel request. So what happens next? Ambassador McCaleb says while the case itself is unique within USMCA, the formal process mirrors other efforts by the U.S. to resolve trade issues with member nations within the agreement.
The process would include actually establishing the panel members, or the judges in this case. Once the panel is established, there will be a period where the participants are able to argue and bring their case and evidence to the USMCA panel. We would anticipate this entire process to wrap up in early 2024, certainly by mid-2024.
The ambassador also points out,
we were also pleased that Canada has decided to join this case as well, along with the United States.
As for the broader look at U.S. ag trade within the context of the USMCA dispute settlement panel with Mexico and efforts to expand our nation's farm and food exports,
we need to hold trading partners accountable. And so this case in Mexico represents an area where we want to make sure that countries are holding to the agreements that they have already signed with us.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
September grain futures off the board, pushing December corn, December wheat, and November soybeans to the front of the line. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report as we end the first half of September, brought to you by Kloss and Helena. Helena says make the most of your valuable fertilizer dollars by improving your soil quality right now. Products like Resurge. Visit HelenaAgra.com to learn more. September corn left the board at over a 20-cent discount to new crop December. September Kansas City wheat had over a 30-cent discount. And September soybeans, a near 15-cent difference. It's not unusual to have these wide discounts or some years premiums as we move to new crop contracts each year. Now, we still look for a weaker trend in all three the rest of September. And looking at the week ahead, keeping our floor on December corn, 474, November soybeans, 1336, 1337, and December Kansas City wheat, 573-574. Refuel your farm equipment for free if you register for $10,000 worth of free farm diesel from Kloss. Go to fuel.kloss.com to register. This is the bottom line report. October live cattle tried twice this week to take out that mid-July high, 175.85. They won't succeed today, but buyers will try again next week. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable week ahead.
Suggestions for U.S. sugar policy. If it's not broken, don't fix it. That's the resounding message from Michigan Congressman Dan Kildee when it comes to the nation's sugar policy.
What we have is a program that works. We have a system right now that ensures that domestically grown sugar is sold into our markets before we allow for competition to come from offshore. This kind of protection allows American sugar growers to not have to face unfair competition from state-subsidized sugar that is grown often using workers in dangerous working conditions.
With that in mind, he has a simple request for Congress as they craft the 2023 Farm Bill.
My goal for this Farm Bill, when it comes to sugar policy, is to not fix what's not broken. It works, and we ought to keep it in place. And I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that's the case.
I am Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
It's fall and football season. In some places, though, what happens inside the stadium isn't as big and elaborate as what's going on in the parking lots outside the stadium with those very elaborate tailgate parties.
People have a full-on little mini city in their parking space. Like, they have music going, they have fans going, they have the crock pots going and all that.
And sometimes grills going as well. That's the voice of experience talking there. Meredith Carruthers is a veteran tailgater and food safety expert with the Agriculture Department's Meat and Poultry Hotline, the number of which we'll give you in a minute. She says tailgating is great fun until tailgaters end up with food poisoning because they don't take precautions to control bacteria that can be on or in raw meat and poultry and other perishable foods. Bacteria are dormant. They don't multiply at temperatures under 40 degrees.
So it's really important to keep it refrigerated because then even if the bacteria is present, it won't be growing or multiplying.
And it's important to then cook the foods to a hot enough temperature to kill any bacteria that may be in the meat. So besides bringing drinks and foam fingers, don't forget those, and flags and music and all of that, Meredith says also, please bring and use a meat thermometer.
I know that people love putting food on the grill and seeing those awesome grill marks, and the food gets browned really quickly and it looks delicious. But even cracking open a burger and looking at the inside to see what the color is on the inside is not a reliable indicator of doneness. You really have to be using that food thermometer to make sure that it's fully cooked to that safe internal temperature,
which is 160 degrees for burgers, 145 with a 3-minute rest time for pork or beef steaks and chops, and 165 degrees for any poultry product. Now, yes, that will assure the death of any bacteria on or in that meat. However, there's bacteria in the air. Meredith says it's on people's hands and other surfaces. And so once you've cooked that meat, she says you should not leave it out longer than 2 hours because that bacteria can multiply rapidly enough then to make people sick.
If it's over 90 degrees Fahrenheit, that time reduces to 1 hour because the warmer it gets, the faster they multiply.
If you have questions about tailgate food safety or any food safety question, call the Meat and Poultry Hotline. Here's the number, 1-888-MP-HOTLINE. And if you call weekdays between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. Eastern Time, you get to talk to a live food safety expert. Or you can do live chat, too, with an expert online at ask.usda.gov. Oh, I almost forgot. Besides bringing all the food and the meat thermometer and the foam fingers, we need really one thing for a top-notch tailgate party, and that is a tailgate of some kind, I would think, right?
Tailgate's not a tailgate without a tailgate.
I guess not. Very profound, Meredith. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Why do we have GMOs? Actually, we've been modifying crops for thousands of years to prevent crop loss from pest and weather damage, to grow more food on less land, even to improve nutrition. Today, GMOs are developed for the same reasons. With genetic engineering, scientists can change and improve crops more easily and quickly. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the show. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Today we have with us Andrew Genasi, the Executive Director of San Joaquin County Farm Bureau. Thanks, Andrew, for taking the time to chat with me today.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thank you for the opportunity.
Of course. We normally get an opportunity to talk with your wife, so it's nice to hear the other Genasi on the phone today. Andrew, you're fairly new to this position. You were working with Farm Bureau. So how are you liking this new position as Executive Director?
Oh, I love it. It's a different challenge. I had been in my position as field staff for over 11 years. And after a while, you kind of develop ruts and you kind of get settled into how your job goes. And it,
right.
You know, every day with Farm Bureau was different. You know, there's always different challenges, and working with 14 different counties, you had a lot of issues to keep the kind of finger on the pulse of, but right. It was time for a new challenge. And so this one, it's a little more direct, you know, focusing on one county and the really diving deep into the issues here. So it's been great. Love the people I work with. So I'm excited for what the next couple of years hold.
Nice. So you and your wife, you guys live in Stanislaus County. San Joaquin County is close to Stanislaus County. And what sort of happens as far as agriculture goes in San Joaquin County?
So Stanislaus and San Joaquin are neighbors. The biggest difference I would say is the Delta, and the south end of the Delta just is right here in San Joaquin County. And so it's over the border, right? So it's Delta mm-hmm. issues are not Stanislaus issues. They're San Joaquin issues Contra Costa, Sacramento County, the counties that hold the Delta. So that's kind of been my biggest learning hurdle is trying to get an arm around the issues, Delta specific issues. So, it's water quality, salinity, stuff like that, how that's all measured mm-hmm. and managed and protecting the farmers and ranchers that live there in the Delta who, if too much water is moved, the salinity creeps up and they're not able to exercise their riparian water rights. It's the hinge everything balances on, right? North and south, mm-hmm. like everything balances on the Delta right now. Mm. So just kind of understanding all that and the ins and outs and the really minutiae of it has been
right
crazy. So. But I'm figuring it out.
So I'm glad you mentioned water rights, because that's exactly what we're talking about today. Our conversation's really going to be around water legislation that have popped up over the last couple years and will continue to pop up, as we've mentioned before, we started recording, really for the next, years to come, how it can be dangerous to the ag industry. So before we get into a few bills that have been hot topic the last couple of years, I'd like to sort of just pick your brain about water rights in general. California water rights system, how is it created? Are they different in each county? And as you mentioned, the Delta, how do big water ways like that affect, different water rights? Can mm-hmm. you sort of give me a brief overview?
Sure. I'm not a water historian by any stretch, but I'll do my best, I guess. So water rights, really going back to the mid-1800s, the gold rush and mining, it was basically you put a claim on you can nail a piece of paper to a tree saying, I'm going to divert, X amount of water for use of my operation. And as long as nobody challenged it, that was your right. And so that was established up until 1913, the legislature started looking at, hey, we need to have a better way of managing this, a more organized way. And so they established the water rights system that we have today in California, the first in time, first in right, recognizing everybody who had established a right of water that's why they call them the pre-1914 rights, because that's when that bill went through. But it established those rights were the highest rights in the state. The pre-1914, you're first in time, those are the highest rights.
You were grandfathered in.
Yep. Okay. And it all built, it's all timeline, right? So the earlier you were in, the higher your right. And basically what they established is, it's a big list. And you start at the top with the first, and then they go, okay, who's next? And then you work down and people ask for rights. And then post 1914, you would go to the state water board and you petition for your rights there, and it basically just added up every year. The new rights kind of got to the bottom of the list, and then as new people went on, they were below them. So that's really first in time, first in right is just kind of how water works in California, at least surface water. It's kind of funny because a lot of people say, oh, the water rights system is oversubscribed and it's not working. Well, the way it's developed, it can't be oversubscribed. It's simply there's a bucket of water and the first person in line gets their right. And then the next person gets their right. And you just move down the line until there's no more water left. And in a short water year, there's, the first people in line get water and the other people don't. And in a long water year like we just had, where there's plenty of water, everybody gets water. And it's just, basically it tells you where everybody is in line. And that's how our system works. And as long as it's enforced that way, the system works fine. Now, there are people who are at the end of the line are going to say, well, that's not fair. Well, That's our water system. And that's what the legislature has established. And that's how it works.
So. Right. So you mentioned the word riparian. And there's riparian rights. And then there's another type of right. Can you kind of give me the difference between the two?
I mean, there's riparian. And then there's like the state water board right system, if I'm understanding the question correctly. So riparian means you're along the river. So as long as you are in a contiguous block along the river and have been exercising that right, you have right to that water, to pull water off the river. Now, it's not a unlimited right. You know, you have to be using it for beneficial use, and it can't be pulled off the river and then sent, you know, inland to different parcels. Like, it has to be contiguous mm-hmm. parcels owned by the same person right along the river. There's very strict rules on how riparian water can be used. Okay. You can't subdivide and then, you know, push that water across your property to another property, to somebody else's property. You can't sell that water outside there. But that water basically means you're right along the river. It's a river right or stream, and you're able to pull natural flow. And that kind of becomes important. It has to be water flowing that was naturally there. And even that, like I said, I'm not a water lawyer, but as I understand mm-hmm. it, it's, you know, the further up the river you are, the earlier you get to pull your water. So, I'm not a riparian expert by any stretch. That's how I understand it. But yeah, you have to be pulling water right off the river. The other water rights are, you are off the river. Usually you have some kind of impoundment, whether it's a dam, you know, some kind of storage area, and you have rights to that water. Claim to that water is the other rights you would be looking at. So not right along the river, but you're off the river, but you're still pulling water from a body of water, of some kind of impoundment. Okay.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
India agreeing to remove retaliatory tariffs on almonds will provide an important boon to the industry. President and CEO of the Almond Alliance, Aubrey Betancourt, detailed the significance of the Indian market and the improved opportunities on the horizon.
That's where we get premium market value for our in-shell almonds, which are in high demand in India. Having the tariff reduction coming at this time couldn't be better, especially when you consider, you know, even pre-pandemic when tariffs went into place, how much that just put an undue handcuff on a market that really was craving more product and was growing as we were growing. And then you compile that with supply chain disruption during the pandemic period. So you had handcuffs on the market. Then you had a breakdown of supply chain, which, of course, contributed very much so to the situation with almonds that you and I have talked about so many times over, of the high carry-in numbers for multiple years. We're really looking to have, you know, it's such a great encourager. Obviously, there's a lot of legwork to be done, but to have these handcuffs taken off with regards to the ability to get product into our largest market and the largest overseas consumer of almonds, we're really looking forward to having that as a boon to the industry and to the market as we look to push product out and get our recovery of, get our recovery as an industry underway.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
business strategy and leadership a focal point at the WIN Expo. The Wine Industry Network is hosting an upcoming expo and conference for the North Coast wine industry. The event is set to take place at the Sonoma County Fairgrounds and Event Center in Santa Rosa come November 30th. One of the many focal points of the conference and expo is business strategy and leadership. The WIN Expo Business Strategy and Leadership Conference track will host three state-of-the-industry sessions covering economic and financial markets, the bulk wine and grape market, and the new winery general order. For the state-of-the-industry economic pressures and financial markets track, Dr. Eiler will provide insight as to what you need to do to position your business in a downturn, as well as be ready to strike at new opportunities as they arise. For the state of the bulk wine and grape markets track, the Chiotti Company will provide valuable insight from recently completed harvest and its anticipated impact on the year ahead. Session facilitators of the state of compliance with the new winery general order will go over California State Water Board's adoption of a general order to regulate waste discharge requirements for wineries across the state that will require facilities producing wine or grape juice to enroll in a new general order come January 20th of next year. To find out more information and to get a 2023 conference overview, you can visit wineindustryexpo.com.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at Agnet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. Agnet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.